I didn't realize until your Facebook page that this is your first book.
It is, and how it came about was that I had written a profile of Margaret for El Palacio magazine, the State Museum's magazine, and she liked it a lot. She and Dan called me back to the gallery, sat me down, and said, "Have you ever wanted to write a book?" And I said, "I've always wanted to write a book, but for two things. I can't think of a topic interesting enough to sustain a book, and I'm not in a financial place where I can spend my free time writing something that doesn't have a guaranteed return." Mm-hmm. And they said, "We can solve both those problems." And it was frightening, the proposal. I'd have to do this on top of a full-time job. I'm not an arts writer. I've never known anything about Helen Hardin before. So I took a meditative hike one day and was hoping for an answer somewhere on the hike. And it wasn't until I was almost home when I heard a voice clear as day inside my head, and all it said was, "Leap of faith." And so throughout this process, I've relied on that. Take a leap of faith. Whenever I got worried about something, take a leap of faith. And things came together like magic.
Tell me what your sources were. I know that Margaret was a source, but tell me some of the other sources.
Helen was an incredible woman, and in her lifetime made friends who have stayed loyal to her to this day, 38 years after her untimely death. In addition, she was a crazy obsessive scrapbook keeper. And there are piles of them, boxes of them, that I got to go through with all the articles that had ever been written about her, photo albums, and so between interviewing the people who are still with us, doing the documentary research, there was an interview that she did back in 1972 with Margaret Connell Jage at the University of New Mexico that was invaluable beyond belief. It was pages and pages and pages of Helen in her own voice. And because I couldn't get that on my own, I really needed an extended interview like that for at least that part of her life. And then there was some research that had been done earlier by Diane E. Williams, and that helped me as well. So it was this mounds of stacks of different pieces of information all over my dining room table for, 6 months.
Did you come to some different viewpoints than what Margaret told you?
To some degree, for sure, because people have Rashomon experiences. And there's even a part where I present it that way. Here are the three different ways that three people saw a situation. In general, though, Margaret has an incredible memory. And as someone who does not have an incredible memory, it's pretty impressive. So I trust her a lot.
Okay. Tell me how you feel about Helen after having, when you're doing a book, it's sort of like a marriage almost.
No, it's not a marriage. It was something mystical. It really was. I felt her with me on throughout the book. There were marvelous ways that the universe provided. I would be researching the next chapter while writing the previous chapter, and I would start stressing out that I needed to interview a certain person for the next chapter, but they were out of the country, and suddenly they'd be in country just in time for me to get started on that chapter. There was one time, Helen's Tewa name was Little Standing Spruce. And she signed her paintings with that, and then with a little drawing of a spruce tree. I moved into a new office. I work at the New Mexico History Museum. And I moved into a new office there, and there was a drawer that I was unfamiliar with. None of the desks had that drawer there. I opened it up. There was nothing in it but a plain white box and a question mark that someone had written on it. Kind of Alice in Wonderland, right? Mm-hmm. So I opened it up. There's nothing but a bunch of keys in it. And every key has stamped on it a little spruce tree. And to me, that was a moment where she was speaking to me. There's a place on my daily hike that I stop to do some meditative prayers, and throughout the writing of this book, I would talk to her there, and she would help me find answers to a transition or how to start a chapter or whatnot. When I finished the book, in tears, I called up Margaret and Dan, and the first thing I said was, "Who am I going to talk to on my hikes now?"
Well, are you hooked? Are you going to do another biography?
I would love to. I'm waiting to see what doors open up next. It was a marvelous experience. It was fast, probably faster than it ought to have been. But I'm a deadline reporter, and that suited my personality. And it was a very emotional, gratifying experience. I'd love to do it again.
Well, thank you for undertaking such a beautiful thing to do, and I can't wait to see it.
Thank you, Susan. I hope everyone enjoys the books.
It's 1982, and what turned out to be Helen's final appearance at Indian Market. She went out with a bang. That year's Indian Market in Santa Fe produced Helen's final blow-up with organizers. The Standards Committee voted to ban all posters, cards, and offset prints. The goal was good. They wanted to protect the market's reputation as a haven of Indian-produced goods. Its effect, though, struck at a bread-and-butter issue for artists, particularly painters, who couldn't count on selling $20,000 paintings, but could reliably secure some name recognition and pocket money through posters and greeting cards. One of the things I loved about Helen was that she wasn't pompous and arrogant, Carol Katz said. She wanted her work to be affordable to all economic groups. In that battle with Swaya, she and her mother had always sold posters for $10 and postcards. She wanted something affordable for beginning collectors or someone not ready to make the leap. The committee's decree may have been inspired in part by an argument the previous year over the market's official poster. One faction had wanted it to bear an image by Helen. Another faction wanted a contest to determine a winner from many applicants. The contest backers won. But Helen's poster, printed by Tanner's Trading Post, dramatically outsold the winning version. Artists protested the 1982 ban to no avail. Ever the rebel, Helen nevertheless showcased her posters in her booth on opening day. Swaya's president visited the booth personally and warned her that she would face trouble next year if she didn't take the posters down. She declined to do so. Outside of such dramas, Indian Market was a high point of the year, and not just for cash infusions. Santa Clara's feast day fell right before it. Friends flew in from out of state. The Katzes opened their Santa Fe home to artists, granting Helen, Craddock, and Margaret a spare room that the Katz children came to call Helen's room. Back then, there weren't all these gallery openings, so Friday night before market, Santa Fe East, the gallery that the King family owned, would have an opening, and a couple of other galleries. And then the tribe would come to my house, Carol said. I would have dinner, and people would bring stuff to eat. We had all these Indian artists. They slept on the floor, they cooked for themselves, they cleaned up after themselves. Nancy and Nathan Youngblood, Jerry Ingram and his wife, Charles LaLoma would come over and hang out. Once he brought Julian Lovato, we met all these interesting people just tagging along. Back then, we tried to be on the plaza at 7 or 7:30 in the morning. There would be a handful of artists setting up. We'd go into Woolworth's and get several cups of coffee for Helen, Pablita, and the Youngbloods. 30 years later, Indian Market has grown beyond that manageable scene to eclipse all other public events in New Mexico. An estimated 100,000 visitors come to the two-day market, which eventually expanded into a week's worth of fashion shows, film series, lectures, demonstrations, and private high-dollar auctions. At the 1982 event, Helen and the Cacciolas turned their newfound friendship into plans for an October show at their gallery. The show introduced New York to Helen and Helen to the New York art world. Both were dazzled. She and Craddock hit galleries and museums, and East Coast critics murmured that Helen was, writer wrote, the heir apparent to Georgia O'Keeffe. John and Judy got her juiced again, Craddock said. Part of her mind began playing with the notion of diving into that world, of claiming a New York zip code, of becoming one of the artists good enough to play on a stage that led to New York Times reviews and penthouse dinner parties. New York, Paris, her horizons expanded. The boutique L'Orangerie in Lausanne, Switzerland opened a discussion with Helen about holding an exhibition there. I think she started to see herself on a pretty high level of art, Craddock said. She also just liked the excitement of everything that went on. She could see herself as being part of New York. She knew she was good, that she was doing something special and different. This is at the end. Irv Hines described a phenomenon that physicians and hospice workers often witness at the end of someone's life. He called it the peace that passes all understanding, after Philippians 4:7. We see people have a period of lucidity in their life, he said. It's almost like a supernatural revelation. This is why they spent time here. There's almost a relief. It's almost like they know something we don't know. I could feel that about her. She was accepting and almost relieved she was moving beyond this existence. There's a mystery about death. Nobody can tell you about that, but maybe you can know it right before you die. The lucency came to her. Maybe that's part of the circle thing. She circled around to this winter awakening of the Okuwa, and the three women, they're all circles. Maybe at the end, she circled back to the beginning, and maybe there was a relief that there was a meaning to all of it. Albuquerque Living Magazine wanted a final interview with Helen. Granting it required a wig, makeup, and a last burst of superhuman strength. Over the next few days, Margaret Craddock and Judy Cacciola took shifts in Helen's round-the-clock care. Family members drifted in and out. Visits from friends dropped off. On June 8th, Helen called the Katzes. The three of them had been writing letters and making phone calls, but this time, Jeffrey and Carol knew something was different. Helen called to say goodbye. As a physician, Jeffrey was disappointed that Helen had chosen to discontinue cancer treatment. As a friend, he felt bereft. "I was so emotional that I couldn't come to the phone," he said. "She was clear mentally," Carol said of the call. "She called to say goodbye, and she did say goodbye. I was crying, and it got quiet between us. And then she said, 'I'll always have one regret. I'll never know if blondes had more fun.'" And then she howled. Oh, that laughter. Later, Helen was less lucid. Or at least it seemed so to those of us on this side of the earthly continuum. With Margaret's help, she got out of bed and tried to walk down the stairs, muttering that she needed to see the other ones. Margaret and Craddock, worried that she would fall, took her back to the bedroom. Prayers of Blue Corn Mother, the painting she had told her family to never sell, hung on one wall. Helen looked at it and said, "I want to go there." The next afternoon, on June 9th, 1984, Helen Hardin went to wherever the Blue Corn Mother was. She lived 12 days past her 41st birthday. In August, Albuquerque Living published a remembrance of her. In it, Patricia O'Connor recounted Helen's response to a question about how she wanted her art to be remembered. She answered, "Forever." It's been 38 years, and while I wasn't lucky enough to know her while she was alive, I have been lucky enough these past 9 months to walk with Helen. And I think we should all let her know that she's still loved and she's still remembered.